tomorrow we may be dead. So tonight we drink and eat and sing. For this is Kislev. The cold never bothered us anyway. This is the War Games Orchard. Welcome to the show. We have a very special and wintry-themed episode for you today. I'm your host, Nathan Stone, and before we hit on our main topic, I have some news for you today. We're going to start things off on the hobby side of things, because I actually have some hobby stuff to tell you about this time. I've been working on something a little bit silly over the last couple of days. I've had the itching for a while now to get into Manowar. The only issue with getting into Manowar is that you need some boats, and you can make proxies out of paper or anything like that. I've never liked non-3D models, so I decided that I would make some. Because Manowar ships are quite small, I figured, how hard could it be? Well, I've made a couple of boats now out of crafting clay and various art supplies and things, and I gotta tell you, they're pretty darn funny looking. I made two ships, each one is about 1.5 inches long, and one is kind of a classic sloop, and the other one is... the other one was intended to be a chaos ship that would have a metal iron shark head on it. This is a ship from the game. It is a corn-themed chaos ship, and the models are pretty cool about it. I think they're called iron sharks. Unfortunately, my enthusiasm does not match my skill set, and this head turned out so dopey looking that I ended up sticking big googly eyes on it, and now it looks like some kind of weird lizard. So I may lean into that. Not sure how this making my own Manowar boats thing is going to go. I am going to paint them up just for the fun of it, make some sales, and stick them on Facebook. I'll put those guys up on the Warhammer Orchard and probably the Manowar page on Facebook in case you guys want to see those and have a little bit of a chuckle. I also got to play a game in the last little while. I played a game of Second Ed 40K with my buddy Patrick. It was 1,500 points of my Chaos versus his Space Marines, and he took a couple of interesting things. He took a Imperial Psyker and an Imperial Inquisitor, and boy oh boy, Inquisitors do not mess around in Second Edition. They are terrifying. Much more so than your average Marine hero, I would say. Just with the amount of different cool war gear they can take, and the fact that they're all powerful psykers, he did a number on me. My poor word bearers lost that game pretty hard. Patrick has this great ability to take psychic powers or spells in Warhammer that don't seem like they're that powerful, and completely use them to devastate me. This is the second time that this has happened in two games, and this time it was the psychic power Assail. And it's just a tiny little thing, and what it does is it moves a model. That's it. It moves a model 6 inches, one of your models or one of the enemy models. And Patrick just kept getting this psychic power off and using it to really good effect to stick one model out of one of my units into a forest, so he had to get out of there and waste some time doing that. He ended up pulling my Chaos Lord out of the relative safety of his accompanying unit, and proceeded to beat him up with a Space Marine Captain and an Inquisitor. He did really, really well, and I managed to kill this stupid psyker that kept casting Assail on me. And didn't Patrick end up having the strategy card that allows him to immediately resurrect with one wound left, and by that point I just never got a chance to kill him again. The one bright spot from this game was my Chaos Predator. It didn't do a whole lot of killing, but it took so much firepower, and he didn't end up killing the thing. At the end of the game, it was immobilized, both of its sponsons were destroyed, two out of the three crew were dead. It was only the turret gunner who was still alive. The turret was locked in place, so it couldn't swivel, and it was damaged, so it could only fire every turn on a 4, 5, or 6. He did the maximum amount of damage to this vehicle without actually destroying it. It was a thing of beauty to watch, because he poured in a ton of firepower to this thing. In the end, unfortunately, I lost by a huge margin, which is now the second game in a row that that has happened. I was incredibly rusty, and I guess that's because this is the first time this year that we have gotten the chance to play Second Ed 40K. And apparently in the intervening weeks, it had just completely disappeared from my mind. So I played pretty terribly, to be fair. All in all, though, lots of fun. Second Ed is always a wild time, even if you lose. That's what I love about it so much. Now I've got some news for you guys. If you listened to last week's episode, I was pumping the tires pretty hard on our upcoming Hero Hammer magazine. I made a mistake. I thought it was going to be out by the time that that last episode aired. We've run into some delays, nothing major, just the logistics of getting this finished up, and there's still a few things left to do. Now the magazine is looking like it will come out at the end of February instead of when I had originally thought. So if you've been looking for it and you haven't seen it around, that's why. It is coming. It's just going to be a little bit later than we thought. It's still going to be awesome, and I still recommend you read that. It's all about Night Goblins, and it is of an incredible quality. I cannot say enough good things about the people involved in this magazine. So please keep staying tuned for that. I will try to avoid making any more prognostications until I know that it is going to be 100% done. The last little bit of news for today is regarding our Patreon. It is time for my shameless plug of the week. And guys, I gotta tell you, February's episode turned out so well. Scott and myself made 100% randomized Warhammer Fantasy roleplay characters. It was a joy to record. We fell in love with these silly, ridiculous characters that ended up coming out of this random process. It is the legend of Dimzad and Ludo, and you can hear that, our January episode on Shadow of the Horned Rat, as well as a story and all sorts of stuff that is coming soon. Our Patreon is non-tiered. You can donate anywhere from a dollar to all of the dollars and get access to all of our bonus content. If you like the show, if you enjoy the show, personally, I think it is worth a dollar. We have a lot of fun with our Patreon content, and I hope that you will see fit to check us out on there. On today's show, we're going to be talking about Kislev and its Ice Queen. Now, why would we do something like that? Well, a couple reasons. For those who are following Warhammer Fantasy and developments in Warhammer the Old World, you will not have missed the Total War Warhammer 3 trailer. And what a trailer it was. It was incredibly cool, starring none other than the Ice Queen of Kislev herself, Serena Catrin, and painted a very chilly picture of war in the north between Kislev forces and demons. We even got a little teaser on Cathay as well. This trailer really inspired me to do this episode where we'll be looking at the history of the Kislevites, Serena Catrin, and her incarnations through both the 4th edition Warhammer Empire book and the 6th edition Kislev supplement. And we're even going to take a sneaky peek at her father, Tsar Boris, as well. This is going to be a lot of fun. It also seems appropriate as right now in Halifax, Canada, it is very cold. We've been going through a bit of a cold snap. We got dumped on with a ton of snow, and the bleak midwinter has finally hit us here. We were having a very nice, mild winter up until about a week and a half ago, and then someone reminded the gods of winter that this is technically Canada, and we have to be cold and miserable through February. One of the funny things about living in Canada is that Canada is often seen as a northern nation. That somehow we are of a hardier breed in that we like the snow and the cold and the ice, when we enjoy cold pursuits and cold sports, like hockey and curling. And yes, while we do have a certain love for those sports, we really don't have any kind of love for the cold here. If you were to take a map of Canada and take a highlighter and just highlight the very bottom edge of Canada and kind of trace your way from the Pacific to the Atlantic, you would cover about 90% of the Canadian population. And that's kind of funny because we are seen as this northern nation, but most of us are just clinging to the American border for warmth. We're really just looking for any kind of warmth we can get, and always have been. So we decided to stay as close to our American cousins as possible, and the rest huge landmass that wouldn't be covered by your highlighter only contains about 10% of our population. To start things off on Kislev, we're going to be looking at the history of the nation. And Kislev is a very underrepresented place in Warhammer Fantasy, at least if you're talking about army books and the main way that people interact with the game, through the rules of their armies and through the rules in the rulebook. You won't really see much of a mention of Kislev, its units, or its peoples, and so much of Kislev history is just glossed over. I had to do a little bit more digging for this episode, and I found an incredible resource. For much of the history in this episode, we're going to be turning to Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, specifically a supplement released by Fantasy Flight Games. And I believe this was released in 2009. This is Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, Realm of the Ice Queen. It was released as a guide to Kislev, the land, the people, and the culture, as well as making characters and adventuring in Kislev. It is an incredible little book that really fills in a lot of those blanks that you would get if you're just looking at what the proper GW releases are. Let's start with the basics. Kislev lies to the northeast of the Empire in the Old World. It is bordered to the west by the Sea of Claws, upon which lies the port city of Erengrad. It's bordered to the west by the World's Edge Mountains. To the north is the dread Chaos Wastes, which lead even further into the realm of Chaos itself. Kislev's northern borders are ill-defined, though it mostly ends with northern Kislev becoming more and more inhospitable until you reach Troll Country or the mountains that border the Chaos Wastes. The River Linsk is most often used as this northern border for reasons of convenience. There's only a few Kislevite tribes that travel further north than the Linsk. The climate in Kislev, as you might imagine, is quite cold, but the Kislevites come from two born and bred northern tribes, so this doesn't bother them quite as much as it would bother soft southerners from the Empire or further abroad. The majority of land is made up of a massive sprawling grasslands known as a steppe. There's not a lot of forests here, as in contrast to the Empire, and the people of Kislev live mostly in small rural villages known as stanistas, or as nomadic tribespeople. What we know as Kislev in modern-day Warhammer is actually quite a young nation. It only dates back to about 1500 on the Imperial calendar, so a scant 1,000 years from the current era. Kislev has an incredible founding myth, and it involves two tribes, the Gospodar and the Ungol. You could think of the Ungol tribes as the more native inhabitants of Kislev. The Gospodars actually migrated to Kislev over the World's Edge Mountains, and this happened around the year 1500. The Gospodars moved westward in a huge migration from the east and the World's Edge Mountains. And if we remember our imperial history during this time, the Empire is a divided nation. There was no political will to stop the Gospodars from conquering these northern lands. and from making war with the Ungles. What really made the Gospodar tribes dangerous was that they were led by a Khan queen. This woman was known as Miska. She was a great warrior, but also a sorceress of unmatched power, and she went about conquering the land that would eventually be Kislev. The Ungles had two major settlements. The first one was Prague. And Prague is maybe one of the unluckiest cities in all of Warhammer, except maybe for Mordheim. But it was not proof against the Khan Queen's magic, and her armies took Prague. They then drove westward toward the city of Norvard. And if you've not heard of Norvard, it's because that when it was conquered by the Gospodars, it was renamed to Erengrad, the port city of Kislev. During the height of the Gospodar conquest, they actually conquered huge swaths of the Northern Empire as well. By the current era, however, most of that land has been won back, and with the Empire and Kislev being about as staunch allies as you can get in the Warhammer world, those gains that the Gospodars made have since been rolled back. There is a much more stable border between Kislev and the Emperor. After the Khan Queen Miska had conquered these huge swaths of northern territory, she would ride into the Chaos Wastes, claiming to have seen a vision of a terrible future where she would once again be needed to lead her people to salvation. She left her symbol of office, the fearsome warblade Fearfrost, to her daughter, Shoika, and Miska was never seen again, though in Kislev there is a legend that she will return at their darkest hour to lead the nation to salvation, and in fact, some Kislevites believe that Serena Katerin, the current ruler, is Miska reborn. Over the next several hundred years, the nation of Kislev would begin to form improper, and the nation got its name because of the city of Kislev, which was founded by the Gospodars as their seat of power. The Gospodars never called themselves Kislevites in the beginning. It was foreigners who started using the term because of their familiarity with the city Kislev, which was both the seat of power and the southernmost city in the nation. Over the centuries, the Gospodar and the Ungles, who have always had these racial tensions between them, started to merge and become a singular people. However, the Gospodar are still the dominant culture within the society, with all of the Tsars and the Tsarinas and nobles being of Gospodar lineage. The Gospodars are far more common as a people in the south of Kislev, and the Ungles are much more common in the north of Kislev. And a lot of those tensions remain despite these many centuries of intermingling. One thing to know about Kislev and ice magic, that while Miska and Katerin are the most famous practitioners of ice magic, they are not the only ones. There is a type of female magic caster in Kislev known as an ice witch, and they too are able to harness the power of the ice magic. Ice magic itself is said to come from the spirits of the land of Kislev. And when Miska first crossed over the World's Edge Mountains, it is said that she had been led by visions granted by the spirits of Kislev, and when she arrived, she knew that she had led her people to their new home. The Ice Witches are of Gospodar descent. The Ungles have their own wise woman. They are known as the Hags. They don't have magical powers in a normal sense. However, these women are much sought after and much respected, as they have some powers of prognostication. Not as flashy as the Ice Witches, but useful in its own right. On their birth, Ungle children are given a prognostication by the Hags of their society. Usually this involves the hag giving the child something relatively common that they must not do. And this is to keep the spirits happy. If the child, or even as an adult, they break this somewhat of a curse. Any number of terrible things may befall them, from bad luck to straight up death. The Ice Witches and the Hags form a very important part of Kislev society, one of the rare societies in the Old World where men and women are equal. Everyone has to do their share in Kislev, because Kislev is not a hospitable climate for humans to survive in. In the spring of 2301, Asavar Kull marched at the head of the largest Chaos incursion yet seen in the Old World, during the Time of Men. His first victim would be Kislev. The first battle was between a mixed army of Kislevites and Empire soldiers, who had mustered to face Kull, but he massacred them north of Prague. This would lead directly to the Siege of Prague, which lasted through the spring and summer months. The city's defenders were successful in hurling back their attackers time and time again, but as winter set in, they could hold out no longer, and Prague fell. With the fall of Prague, the Realm of Chaos was able to expand, and for a time, use its warping powers on the city. Prague became a distorted, hellish reflection of its former glory, and you could see faces distorted in the walls, limbs writhing from pavements and grounds, and pillars of stone that groaned in agony. Luckily for both Kislev and the civilized world, Magnus the Pious would come in and save the day. He was a great orator from the Empire who raised an army and marched to the relief of Kislev. They arrived too late to save Prague, but they were able to break the siege of Kislev. It is said that during this final battle at the gates of Kislev, that the Kislevites were driven to a wild fury by the terror wrought upon their beloved land, that the host of Asavar Kull was butchered by the implacable anger of these combined forces. Thousands of warriors of the Dark Gods were hacked down as they turned to flee. For a full 2 centuries, Kislev struggled to recover from the devastation caused by the Great War. Its population had been much reduced, and its infrastructure was in ruins. Prague had to be razed to the ground and rebuilt, though it never really escaped the evil of chaos, and we'll discuss Prague in more detail quite soon. This was a time of great tribulation for the Kislevites. They had to deal with rampaging greenskins from the mountains, beastmen from troll country, and even the Skaven from unknown warrens beneath the earth had risen up to take advantage of the chaos. Tsar Vladimir Boka was the first Tsar since the Great War to begin a systematic campaign to push those enemies from his lands, and his initial efforts were quite successful, though he was killed in a battle against goblins in the east of Kislev. To come to Vladimir's son, we have a name that you might recognize. Tsar Boris Broka. He was a fiery, passionate warrior, and the hags of Kislev predicted he would fight hard and die well. He continued his father's work, emptying the treasuries to hire mercenaries to retrain the Kislev army, rebuilding bridges, roads, and towns, and importing black powder and engineers from the Empire. And though it almost bankrupted his family, and apparently several other noble families in the bargain, Tsar Boris's reign would forever be remembered for his driving spirit and eagerness to reclaim the lands that had become infested with vile creatures. Now, if you had been following the teasers for Total War, you might recognize a little bit of this next part, because we're going to talk about the way that Tsar Boris brought about the revival of the cult of Ursin. Ursin being one of the gods of Kislev, and one that had been overtaken in worship by Ulrich, Tal, and other foreign human gods. Ursin is a bear god, which I suppose is pretty on the nose, and he is mentioned in the teasers that led up to the Total War III reveal. I like that they put that level of detail into this. Tsar Boris was a follower of Ursin and wanted to reignite that religion in Kislev. To do so, he undertook the Trial of Initiation that priests of Ursin must overcome. He went into the forests to tame a bear. That is the trial. He was not seen or heard from again for 3 weeks, and many feared that he had died at the hands of some foul creature, or perhaps a bear. Preparations actually began for the coronation of Catherine, his, at the time, infant daughter. However, on the 19th day, search parties that had been sent out for him came upon his body that was guarded by a bear of gigantic proportions. And this bear would not allow anyone near. The Tsar was also surrounded by the corpses of over 24 wolves, and the snow was stained red with blood. Nothing the searchers could do could lure the bear away from the Tsar, or convince it that they meant no harm. Finally, a day after that, Boris awoke, and the bear allowed his men to approach and tend to his many wounds. When this story reached the peasantry and commoners of Kislev, it became folklore instantaneously. Everyone was amazed that their Tsar could pull off this incredible feat. And as the stories have told, 4 days before being found by the searchers, and after much wandering, Tsar Boris came across the mightiest bear he had ever seen, with teeth and claws like sword blades. Taking this as a sign from Ursin, he had confronted the beast, and it charged him, the ground shaking with the fury of its charge and a blood-curdling roar echoing through the forest. With his bare hands, he fended off the creature's attacks, but could not overpower it. The struggle lasted a full day before a wolf pack, drawn by the scent of their combined blood, attacked. The wolves immediately went for the bear, but Boris sprang to its aid, crushing their skulls with his fists and tearing them from its back. Boris was badly wounded, however, and fell beneath the attacks of the wolves. As the beasts closed in for the kill, the bear protected his erstwhile enemy from a common foe. It stood over the supine Tsar, tearing the wolves apart with its claws and savaging them with its powerful jaws. Boris had slipped into unconsciousness, yet each time he drifted awake, the bear had been there, protecting him from the wolves. The bear returned to Kislev with the Tsar, and from then on, whenever Boris took to the field of battle, it was atop the back of Erskine, which means bear brother, both a symbol of Ursin's power and affection for Boris, and an implacable enemy in battle. Later on, we will look at Boris's profile in 6th edition, and my goodness, if ever there was a man who could fight a bear, well, barehanded, it was this guy. A very cool character, so glad that he got rules in the game. Unfortunately, for there to be a Tsarina Catherine, there can no longer be a Tsar Boris. And he met his end in a battle in 2517, whilst leading a polk, and a polk is a Kislevite army or force. He was leading them north of the Linsk into Troll country. At an unnamed river crossing, the Tsar charged deep into a Kurgan army of marauders, but was soon surrounded and cut off from the rest of his army. He and Erskine fought with all the might and fury of the bear god, but even Red Boris, as he had come to be known, could not triumph against such odds. Erskine was able to fight his way clear of the Kurgans and carry the Tsar back to the rest of his army. Unfortunately, it was already too late. The Tsar had taken a score of wounds, each one enough to be mortal. Such was his fortitude that only when the battle was won did the Tsar slide from the back of Erskine and die. His faithful mount roared in mourning for a full night before vanishing into the bleak Northlands. The legends of Kislev have it that to this very day, Erskine continues to hunt down the creatures of chaos that slew his master. The story of Boris is an incredible one. I love this character so much. I remember when he was introduced in 6th edition, and this is a symptom of Kislev really never getting the attention it deserves in Warhammer Fantasy. I just remember him as the special character on the bear. I never really looked into him very much, and it's unfortunate that I didn't, because he has an incredible backstory. Now, with the death of Tsar Boris, Catherine became Tsarina of Kislev. By this point in her life, she was fully grown, and she is the latest in a long line of rulers descended from the ancient Khan queens of the Gospodars. Her ascension took place in 2517, and she's described as a great sorceress in her own right. Her power is said to come from the very land of Kislev itself, its icy soul and bleak tundra, giving her command of the elements and mastery of the form of wizardry known as ice magic. So complete is her grasp of this dangerous branch of magic that some whisper that she is the living reincarnation of that very first Khan Queen, Miska. Upon her ascension to the throne of Kislev, it is said that the Boka palaces grew a new wing, hundreds of yards in length, and formed entirely of glittering ice. This wondrous creation would be beyond all but the most powerful ice mages, and it is here that Catarin remains most of the time, granting audiences in an immense chamber of magically woven hoarfrost. Some believe that she simply prefers the chill of these frozen corridors, while others say that it is a display of her power to overawe would-be enemies and foreign ambassadors. You can kind of imagine Catarin as a cooler Elsa, like one without all of the issues. That would be Catarin. As you would expect from an ice queen, Catarin is aloof and remote. She prefers to work through agents and generals, and only under the direst circumstances will the Serena join her armies. But when she does, it is often upon a mighty steed whose flanks shimmer with glinting ice crystals and whose breath is the winter wind. I wanted to add that little section about the horse, because as you will see when we get to her actual stats in Warhammer Fantasy, they do not do that justice. She gets the most basic warhorse possible in both versions of her stats. She also sometimes rides in an armored sled drawn by a team of identical beasts. Man, where was that miniature? When she goes to battle, she carries the fearsome warblade known as Fearfrost, a weapon said to have been forged by the first Khan Queen, Miska, whose intense cold can kill with a single scratch. This blade has passed from Serena to Serena over the ages, and only a Serena can wield the blade. Were a man to lift the blade, he would find himself frozen solid in a heartbeat. On those rare occasions she does lead an army into battle, the devotion lavished upon her is beyond that which might be expected of such a remote ruler. Her power over the elements is clear proof that the blood of the Khan Queens flows in her veins, and the Ungles of the North fear and respect her as one of the ancient warrior witches from their oldest myths. It makes sense that the Ungles would have a much more standoffish and apprehensive view of the Serena, as it was her ancestors that conquered their people and subjugated them in the past. Now that we know a little bit about Kislev and its people and its heroes, we should spend a little bit of time talking about the three great cities of Kislev. Kislev is, on the whole, a quite rural place, with its people either living in small villages or being nomadic. However, it boasts three great cities. Its westernmost city is Erengrad. Erengrad is one of the great ports of the Old World. Some say second only to Marienburg. It is the most cosmopolitan city in Kislev, sporting a elf quarter, a Bretonian quarter, and attracting people from all over the continent. Erengrad might also be home to the most number of worshippers of various Old World gods anywhere in the Old World, except maybe Altdorf. Not only are there temples to the gods of Kislev, to the Empire, the Bretonian Quarter is home to a Chapel of the Lady. The Elf Quarter has their own religious temple. You will find just about every god in the Old World represented within the city of Erengrad. Erengrad is built around Erengrad Bay, which looks out upon the Sea of Claws. The city itself is prone to intense flooding in the spring of the year, and thus the wealthier citizens of Erengrad live within the high part of the city, whilst the poor have to make do living by the river itself and by the bay, which means that their existences tend to be partially nomadic within the city itself, as occasionally their homes may be somewhat submerged. In the Storm of Chaos campaign, and in that timeline, Erengrad was sacked by the Chaos forces as they marched on Middenheim. And what's interesting is, since this book, where I have done most of the research from, was published in 2009, it uses that post Storm of Chaos fluff as the canonical source. So we get a picture of what a rebuilding Erengrad looks like in this book, which is really interesting, and it certainly suffered less than Prague did during the Great War Against Chaos and the Storm of Chaos. Prague is the oldest city in Kislev, and it was built by the Ungles before the coming of the Gospodars, and it has had a tragic past. It's located in the east of Kislev, on the River Linsk, and near the mountain passes through the World's Edge Mountains to the east. It's a natural trade hub, and during its heyday, was a very wealthy city. It got the name the Silver City because it was such a trade hub, and the Kislevites of the surrounding regions would come in to trade their goods in Prague. The nobles of Prague were keen to keep the economy of the city going, not only for their own enrichment, but because it made Prague important to the Gospodar rulers down in Kislev. Prague has always been the most vulnerable major city to chaos incursions, simply by being the most northernly city in Kislev. In the early days, the city attracted fine craftsmen of many different arts. The city was known for having the best silversmiths, jewelers, embroiderers, tapestry weavers, clockmakers, and cameo painters in all of the Old World. Many of them used ancient Ungle designs and techniques, which were considered exotic by the people of the south. One of the city's key attractions was the Great Opera House, and it was followed by an academy of music and an observatory. Prague was also a place that the study of wizardry was encouraged, one of those few rare cities. Prague has always been a very independent-minded city, with its high Ungle population. It has, on many occasions, tried to secede from Kislev, and each time that has been put down. Eventually, after the third attempt, the ruling Serena displaced Prague's rulers and appointed her own agents to rule over the city. Prague's fate was to change in the Great War Against Chaos that we touched on earlier, and things have been bleak for the city ever since. The whole city had to be burnt down and rebuilt after the Great War Against Chaos. However, this did not cleanse the city as the Kislevites might have hoped. In the years after the Great War, during the rebuilding, as the survivors dwelt among this half-ruined city, they started to notice that the taint of chaos had not left nor diminished. Occasionally walls would sprout eyes. Mutation was rife. Black blood ran from the wells, and sometimes carpets of living, moaning flesh slid across the surface of the river. It was a full century before birds were heard again in the sky. However, the Kislevites, if they are one thing, are stubborn, and they would not abandon the city. They rebuilt it piece by piece with whatever they could find. And to this day, the city has a haphazard look, and parts of the city have had to be abandoned almost entirely. One of the largest sections of the city, dubbed Newtown, even though it is many, many centuries old, has been abandoned and left for the most desperate of desperate to dwell in. It appears that no amount of cleansing can clean this particular area of Prague. It was built with narrow and densely packed houses, and its closeness to the North Gate, the gate that was breached by the Chaos Horde, meant that it bore the brunt of the attack on the city. A couple of centuries after the Great War Against Chaos, and this part of the city is still a virtual hellscape. The drains are scabrous sores that ooze stinking liquids, and the sickly air chokes with insects spawned endlessly from the piles of mutated corpses. The wind whispers murderous thoughts, and the muddy streets are full of deadly quicksand. The law will not follow criminals here, and only the most desperate or the most perverse stay long. Cultists and rebels can meet safely amongst the ruined streets, but they too leave quickly, lest the price is too high. The streets could shift, and they might never find their way out. Occasionally, controlled fires and demolitions are carried out in the quarter. but the taint remains, and most residents of Prague have accepted it. It's terrifying to think that there might be an entire part of your city that, if you go to, might kill or mutate you, or both. Prague is now also home to a huge furnace crematorium. The people of Prague quickly realizing that any body that they buried would not stay buried within the city, as the dark magic that still lingers around Prague makes it so that the dead rise. Now the citizens have to burn every corpse. It's quite a place. Now on to the city of Kislev itself, a much less tragic place than Prague. It began as the town of Pelzburg, along the river Erskoy. It was founded about 2,000 years ago, and it enjoyed relative prosperity in its dealings with the roving tribesmen of the Ungol and the migrating Gospodars, as well as hardy merchants from the empire that would make the trip north. As it grew, the city established strong trading links with the dwarfs and other nations of the Old World. It was unfortunately razed to the ground when that great migration of Gospodars came over the World's Edge Mountains under the leadership of Khan Queen Miska. No sooner had the Gospodars burnt it to the ground that Miska immediately began rebuilding the city, as she was aware of its prime location. And that's what they tell you about real estate. It's location, location, location. And she was the one that gave it the name Kislev. Unlike Prague and Arengard, Kislev has never been taken by an invader, not even during the Great War Against Chaos or the Storm of Chaos. One interesting piece of trivia is that the walls of Kislev are said to be the highest walls of any city of the Old World. What's kind of neat about the cities of Kislev, and it holds true for most of the cities in the Empire as well, is they're all built around rivers. And with the cities of Kislev, the saying that a river runs through it is quite literal. All of these cities seem to be built in a circular pattern around a particular river. Unsurprisingly, Kislev is one of the wealthiest cities in the Old World. It is a hub of trade and a stop for visitors traveling north or east from major parts of the empire. It is here that you will find the Boka's Palace, the seat of the Ice Queen and the center of her power. Now let's take a look at how Kislev's ruler has been portrayed in Warhammer Fantasy. We've got two stops on today's tour, and the first one is going to take us back to the early 90s. We're going to start our unit overview today in the 4th edition Empire Army Book. This army book is an interesting beast, released in 93 and re-released again, I believe, around 96. It is very much a 4th edition army book as opposed to a 5th edition army book. You will find a distinct lack of the streamlining we got in 5th edition around certain choices. However, it is a great book with plenty of fun art, interesting units, and choices that we would not see before or after. Well, you might be thinking, wait, weren't we talking about Kislev this whole time? Why are we in the Empire? Well, we're in the Empire because Kislev never really got the attention that they deserved from Games Workshop, something that I'm sure the upcoming Old World release will remedy. But in the Hero Hammer era, just because Kislev didn't have a army book didn't mean you couldn't take a bunch of Kislevites. The way you would do this is in an Empire army. Kislev and the Empire, especially in the modern era of Warhammer Fantasy, are quite close allies as kingdoms. You could straight up take Kislev units in your Empire army. They were described as allies, but they didn't count against your allied allotment. And in fact, they just counted as regiments, or if you took the Tsarina herself, she was a special character of the Empire. All told, we got 3 units from Kislev in this book. We got the Kislev Winged Lancers, a cavalry unit. We got the Kislev Horse Archers, a skirmishing fast cavalry unit, something that is very valuable, and we got Serena Catarin. When I decided to put together this episode, there was really only one choice for which unit to focus on, and that had to be Serena Catarin. She is a very interesting unit in both of her incarnations that we're going to look at today. In Hero Hammer, she is a unique, special character wizard. To include her, you needed to include at least one unit of Kislev troops, and considering that the Horse Archers are a great unit to take, and the Winged Lancers just look incredible, isn't a big ask. Serena would cost you 200 points, plus another 100 points if you wanted to take her sword Fearfrost. And where this is a 4th edition army book and not a 5th edition army book, they gave you the choice of whether or not you wanted to arm her with her sword. Spoiler alert, you do not. It's not very good, especially at 100 points. On a combat character, I could see it being worthwhile, but for her, and as you'll see, her stats are suspiciously bad, it is really not worth the price of admission. Serena has a movement of 4, a weapon skill of 4, ballistic skill 3, strength 3, toughness 3, 3 wounds, initiative 5, 3 attacks, and leadership 10. She rides a warhorse, which is just a normal warhorse. Equipment-wise, she carries the magical weapon Fearfrost, and that is it. However, she does have the option for some magic items. The Serena may carry up to 3 magic items, including the magic sword Fearfrost. Other magic items may be chosen from the cards in the Warhammer Battle Magic as usual. What's important to note is that may carry up to 3 other items, including the magic sword Fearfrost. In this case, what you would want to do is dump the sword Fearfrost, because as we can see, she is not a combat character, and take something else that's going to be better for her. What bothers me about the Serena in Hero Hammer is how weak they made her physically. She is a master wizard. She's a level 3 wizard in this edition, and thus we can compare her directly to a human master wizard. The Master Wizard has a movement of 4, a weapon skill 3, ballistic skill 3, strength of 4, toughness of 4, 3 wounds, initiative 5, and 2 attacks, with a leadership of 7. Serena, with her weapon skill of 4 and attacks of 3, has a bit of an advantage here, but she loses out on those points of strength and toughness, which I think are a little bit more important, since attacks can be pretty easily made up with magic weapons. It kind of bugs me that she seems to have been toned down specifically in this case, and I don't know if that's Games Workshop picking on her because she's a girl or what, but it's a really weird design choice there. The extra weapon skill and attack, but only strength 3, toughness 3. Let's look at her sword. Fearfrost was forged by the ancient Khan Queen Miska of the Gospodars in the ancient days when the tribes of Kislev first journeyed to the west. Miska led her hordes deep into the Empire itself, defeating 2 Empire armies and causing considerable destruction before an alliance of the Empire, Bretonnia, and Dwarfs finally threw back the Kislev hordes. Since those times, the Tsar of Kislev and the Emperor have forged a common alliance against the threat of chaos. The blade Fearfrost is the heirloom of the Tsarinas of Kislev. Only a Tsarina can wield it, and if any man were to even touch the blade, he would instantly be frozen to death. The intense cold radiating from the weapon will slay anyone it cuts. If the Tsarina scores a successful wound with this weapon, the victim automatically suffers a further d6 wounds. Normal armor is ineffective against the magic of Fearfrost, so only foes wearing magic armor get a saving throw. This isn't a bad item, but at 100 points, its usefulness is suspect, and especially with her profile, weapon skill 4, 3 attacks at strength 3, you're going to struggle just to wound a character or a monster with this, let alone actually get it through and do those fun d6 wounds. There's just no reason that Catarin should ever be in close combat, honestly. She's just not built for it. Her other special rule is regarding magic spells. The Serena is a level 3 wizard, a master wizard. She has 3 spells dealt to her at the start of the battle in the usual way as described in Warhammer Battle Magic. However, the Serena does not use the color magic spells of the spell decks in Warhammer Battle Magic. Instead, she has her own ice magic spell deck. This is, to my knowledge, unique amongst the characters of Warhammer Fantasy. I don't know of any others that got their own spell lore that only they can use. We're going to go over the spells of ice magic and see which ones are worthwhile. I think this is actually a pretty good deck. I think there are much worse choices that armies have to deal with than the ones that Katarin gets all to herself. The only downside, and this is a downside for everyone in the Hero Hammer era, is that this is a 10-card spell deck. Katarin will only ever get 3 of those, and they are completely randomized, so you do not get to choose, ever. Her first spell is Freeze Water. This is one of the least useful spells and more thematic spells. It allows her to freeze a body of water on the battlefield, and that body of water remains frozen for the rest of the game, unless a bright wizard casts a fire spell on that same body of water, in which case it melts again. Why you would ever have this duel to see who can freeze or unfreeze water, I'm not sure, but you have that option. Could be a really interesting one if you are fighting across a river, maybe with some river crossings, and suddenly you just freeze the whole river. That'd be kind of cool. Again, situational, fluffy. It's only power 1, but you're still going to feel bad when you draw this spell. The second one is Bridge of Ice. This is much better. This spell enables the caster to transport a friendly or an enemy unit, or a single model, up to 18 inches across the table in any direction. Affected troops are swept up upon a heaving bridge of ice and carried rapidly to their new location. Troops may be moved over intervening models, buildings, terrain, and any other obstacles or scenery. Troops may be moved onto a castle wall, rocky pinnacle, or other elevation, including a spiral stair. The bridge of ice may be used to move friendly troops into hand-to-hand combat, in which case they may fight from the following combat round and count as charging in the first round. This is a power 2 spell, and oh my god, this spell is so good. This might be one of the best spells I've ever read, especially as a power 2. The ability to move a unit 18 inches across the table in any direction is utterly insane. You may notice as well that there is no range specified on this spell. You can do this straight from turn 1 to almost any unit. And this can take units entirely out of the game. The average game in the Hero Hammer era lasts somewhere between 4 and 6 turns. A lot of units aren't fast enough to recover from that kind of thing. This spell is just so good. It's one that I can't get over. I think it might be the best spell in this spell deck that I rate quite highly. Her third spell is Death Frost. You don't want Serena in combat, but if she is stuck in combat, you do have a spell that could be really useful. This spell can only be cast in hand-to-hand combat, and it has to be cast on a model in base contact with Katarin. Parts of the opponent are frozen solid and turned into ice, causing terrible wounds or killing them outright. To determine the damage caused, roll 2d6. The difference in the dice scores indicate the number of strength 10 hits inflicted. If you roll a double, then add the dice together to determine the number of strength 10 hits. Work out wounds and saving throws for each hit as normal. This is an odd one, and it's oddly worded. You'll roll 1d6 and say, get a 2, roll another d6 and get a 5. The difference between the 2 and the 5 is going to be the number of hits that you score. So in this case, a difference of 3. What you really want is that nice double, because that will drop pretty much anything in the game if they have to take 8 or 10 or 12 strength 10 hits. I don't rate this spell particularly highly because it is power 3, and you have to have Katarin in close combat, which I think is a bad idea just in general. However, if you draw it, it might be worth as a gamble, throwing her into something big, trying to get this off and maybe just absolutely ruining a character or a monster's day with Death Frost. Next up is the Hawks of Miska. This spell doesn't do any direct damage, and it has to be cast at someone within 18 inches of her. From out of the air about the target, suddenly appear a flock of hawks, fashioned from ice. They wheel about the sky, fading and crystallizing out of the air, to the horror of their victims, striking fear into their hearts with their piercing cries. The unit must take a fear test immediately, just as if it had been charged by an enemy that caused fear. If this test is failed, the unit must flee. If engaged in hand-to-hand fighting, the unit will break if it fails this test, and may be pursued, just as if it had been broken in hand-to-hand combat. Units not subjected to fear cannot be affected by this spell. A fancy way of saying it makes your opponent take a fear test. It's nice that they must flee if they fail it. Could be situationally good, especially against units that don't have the greatest leadership, and might be good to win you a combat that otherwise maybe you wouldn't have. It's only a power one. I don't mind it. Next up is Chill Blast. This is our first direct damage spell, and it's a power 3. It strikes the first unit in its path within its range of 24. The target unit is chilled to the bone, causing limbs to snap and weapons to break. The Chill Blast inflicts 2d6 strength 5 hits, and no saving throws are allowed for armor. This could be really good to wipe out a big unit of cavalry, or just put a nice dent into pretty much anything. Power 3 is going to be hard to get off, but a devastating spell against anything that relies on armor to keep it alive. The next spell is the Shield of Cold. The caster may cast this spell onto herself. It will surround the caster and any unit they are with a shield of intense coldness. Any missile weapon must roll a 4, 5, or 6 on a d6 to penetrate the Shield of Cold. Roll to penetrate the Shield of Cold, and then roll again for hits with any penetrating shots. Roll for each shot separately. The Shield of Cold is automatically dispelled if the wizard or unit she is with enters hand-to-hand combat, but otherwise remains in play for the remainder of the battle until it is dispelled. The Shield of Cold does not protect against magical attacks of any kind, but only against ordinary missile weapons. It does protect against shots from war machines. This one is only a power 1. It's fairly situational. Depends on how much shooting your enemy has. If you're playing against dwarves with all organ guns, I would highly recommend it. But it is of limited use. I do wish there was some kind of protection it offered you in close combat as well. But for only power 1, we don't expect a whole lot. Next up is Ice Shards. Ice Shards is a power 2. So it's a downgrade from the Chill Blast that we saw earlier. Sharp icicles fly out of the caster's hand and strike the first unit or model in their path to a range of 18 inches. The ice shards cause 2d6 strength 4 hits on their target. Armor saving throws apply as normal. Still useful, but not going to give you that punch against heavy cavalry. Good for thinning out infantry units though. And at power 2, I think it's okay. Next up is Snow Blizzard. A raging snow blizzard envelopes a unit within 18 inches, and the driving ice-laden winds bring the unit to a halt. The target may do nothing until the beginning of the following magic phase, regardless of which side's turn it is next. It may not move, shoot missiles, or fight in hand-to-hand combat, and no wizard within the unit may cast further spells. Although a wizard affected by this spell may not cast spells, he continues to use dispel cards from the Winds of Magic. If the target is engaged in hand-to-hand combat, the spell will also affect all troops which are fighting against it. This is, I think, my second favorite spell in this deck. This is another spell that can just shut down a unit. Not quite as good, to my mind, as the Ice Bridge, but getting a unit to do nothing is pretty great, especially where you may be only playing for 4 turns. What's interesting to note is the wording of this spell, where it says, "The target may do nothing until the beginning of the following magic phase, regardless of which side's turn is next." In 4th edition fantasy, you could cast spells in your opponent's magic phase. It was very much like 2nd edition Warhammer 40,000 in this regard. By 5th edition, this had changed to just casting spells in your own phase. But since the Empire book was never updated for 5th edition, this spell continued to have this wording, and it wouldn't have come into play in 5th edition, of course, because you couldn't cast spells in your opponent's phase. Just an interesting little holdover from the earlier era there. We have two more spells to go. This next one is Crystal Cloak. The interesting thing about this spell is it would be removed from the 6th edition spell list of ice magic, and that's because Catarin gained it as a magical item instead. A swirl of ice and snow enfolds the caster in a cloud of shimmering light. Any hit scored against the caster by an ordinary weapon is deflected on the d6 roll of 3 or more. If hit by a magic weapon, the crystal cloak is immediately dispelled, but no damage is suffered from the hit, and the magic weapon which inflicted the hit will be destroyed on the d6 roll of 3 or more. This spell remains effective for the rest of the game, until it is dispelled, or until the caster is slain. This spell goes well with the Shield of Cold spell to give Catarin a immense amount of defense against ordinary missile weapons and helps solve her problems in hand-to-hand combat. Unfortunately, it is immediately dispelled if hit by a magical weapon, which means you don't want Catarin in duels against other characters, not that you did already. It certainly makes her a lot more difficult to remove if this power is up against pretty much anything else. I like this one slightly more than the Shield of Cold. At power 2, it is more expensive, but I imagine a very interesting draw of spells might be Crystal Cloak, Shield of Cold, and Death Frost. If you could get the Shield of Cold and Crystal Cloak up, she becomes very hard to stop before she reaches her target. If she can successfully cast Death Frost and do some strength 10 hits against something, she could be a very interesting, almost bomb of a character. Not a competitive choice, I don't think, but it would be a very interesting draw of spells. The last spell is Wind of Cold. A howling wind of cold shoots 6d6 from the caster and strikes each target in its path. The biting winds are laden with icy and freezing rain, making it impossible for the target to fight or move. Any units or individual models struck by the blast will suffer d6 strength 5 hits, with no saving throw allowed for armor. This is a power 3 spell with a random range. I would rather have Chill Blast if I'm looking at direct damage spells. This one can hit units that are stacked up behind each other, but otherwise it's really just a less powerful version of Chill Blast. I would like that one instead. This power deck is really interesting. There's a lot of good stuff here. I think its main strength is in shutting down or moving enemy units to places they don't want to be. I'm not huge on a lot of the damaging spells, except maybe Chill Blast, but even then that's a power 3 and much harder to get off. I would consider the best spells here Bridge of Ice, Snow Blizzard, and Crystal Cloak. And that's what I would like to draw. Perhaps Hawks of Miska as well. I think that spell has a lot of utility. Any which way you slice it, I think the Ice Magic is a really good deck. And I would consider Catarin at 200 points, plus giving her a few magic items, so maybe 300 points all told, as a really fun, different choice for an Empire army. Something perhaps themed as an alliance in the Northern Empire or in Kislev to fight some Chaos Force. I think there's a lot you can do with her. And it's always nice to see those 4th edition special characters where you don't have to take their ludicrously overpriced magical items. I'm a bit sad that that disappeared for 5th edition, because it would have made a lot of the 5th edition characters a lot more viable. That's all we're going to look at in the 4th edition Empire book. Now we're heading over to 6th edition, and we actually have a proper Kislev supplement. Well, I say proper. It wasn't a actual army book. It was more of a White Dwarf supplement here, which was designed around adding a Kislev allied contingent to your army. However, it had enough units and even gave you permission that if you wanted to run Kislev as a full army and just run it pure, you could do that. It just didn't have as many options as other armies of the era. This was to be the closest we would come to a full Kislev army in Warhammer Fantasy, and it had some really interesting units. At the hero level, it had the Kislev Boyar. The Winged Lancers were back, and they were a core unit. It had the Ungol Horse Archers, and it added a infantry unit and the Kislev Corsairs. We added a special unit, the Griffin Legion. They were basically the even better version of the Kislevite Winged Lancer. And in this, we got two special characters. We got our Ice Queen, as we would expect. We also got her father, Tsar Boris Ursus, the Red Tsar. This guy is pretty incredible. We touched on his lore earlier. And after we look at Katerin, we are going to take a little bit of time to look at Boris, because he is incredible. I love Boris. In the 4th edition look at the Serena, I complained about her profile. And this profile is worse. That being said, all of the profiles were worse in 6th, so I'm not going to hold that against her. Wizards, in general, had their stats completely destroyed between the transition from Hero Hammer to the 6th to 8th edition era. Katerin is no exception to that. This time, however, instead of a base 200 points, she's going to cost you 495 points. She does have some extra tricks, though, and she has become a better wizard. So we'll see if that all evens out in the end. Here are her stats. She is movement 4, weapon skill 4, ballistic skill 3, strength 3, toughness 3, 3 wounds, initiative 3, 1 attack at leadership 10. So she's lost some attacks, she's lost some initiative. She still rides just a basic warhorse. For weapons and equipment, she carries Fear Frost and wears the Crystal Cloak. Here are her special rules. She uses ice magic, and she is a level 4 wizard. She is beloved of Kislev. The people of Kislev are utterly devoted to the Serena and would gladly lay down their lives for her. Any Kislevite unit joined by the Serena becomes stubborn, and all Kislevite units within 12 inches of Serena may re-roll failed psychology tests. I'm a big fan of this rule, especially given the fluff that we have explored around her. It makes perfect sense. She has protectors of the Khan Queen. If the Serena Katerin is taken as the leader of your allied contingent, then the 0-1 restriction on Griffin Legion units is waived. Also nice if you wanted to do a very elite Kislev force. And here is Fear Frost. Fear Frost grants the Serena the Killing Blow special skill. Models wounded but not killed outright by Fear Frost receive no saving throw, but may take ward saves as normal. Still ignores regular armor, and gives her the Killing Blow special rule. I guess that's alright. She's only still got one attack. It just... This sword is ceremonial. Please don't actually try and use it in battle, I guess is what I'm saying, in either the Hero Hammer era or the later era. But she does have the Crystal Cloak, which is her spell-turned item. Swirling mists of dancing ice crystals surround the Serena, warding off the most serious injuries and confounding her foes' attempts to strike her. The Crystal Cloak grants the Serena a 4+ ward save. In addition, all attacks directed against the Serena in close combat suffer a -1 to both the to-hit and to-wound dice. This is very nice. A 4+ ward save never goes amiss, and -1 to hit and to wound is very statistically significant. Most good units would normally wound her on a 3, now they're wounding her on 4s. With her weapon skill of 4, a lot of things might only hit her on a 5. This, combined with the ward save, should keep her alive for longer than you would think. Again though, keep Serena out of combat. She doesn't belong there, please don't put her there. Now let's look at how her spells have changed. Magic was completely redesigned between 5th edition and 6th edition. The card system of the Hero Hammer era fell away. Instead, we got the magic lore pages. This is what you will be familiar with if you played primarily in the 6th to 8th edition eras, and for most spell lores, we're limited to 6 spells instead of the 10 or so that we saw in the Hero Hammer era. The lore of ice consists of 6 spells: Shardstorm, Freezing Blast, Form of the Frost Fiend, Invocation of the Ice Storm, Midwinter's Kiss, and Glacial Barrier. Interesting that none of the spells from the old ice magic lore made the cut here. As you would expect, they are organized from easiest to cast to hardest to cast, and Serena would have 4 of these 6. The first one is Shardstorm, casts on a 6+. The caster stretches out her hands and unleashes a torrent of diamond-hard icicles at her foes. Shardstorm is a magic missile with a range of 24 inches. If successfully cast, it hits the target and causes 2d6 strength 3 hits. A wizard can automatically swap one spell for Shardstorm if you wish. First spell of the lore, it's not incredible, though again we have to remember that compared to the Hero Hammer era, magic here is quite toned down, and it wouldn't get crazy again until 8th edition, so don't expect these to be game-breaking spells. 2d6 strength 3 hits is perfectly fine to clear out some infantry, though. Next up is Freezing Blast, which casts on an 8+. This spell can be on a water-based terrain feature such as a river, swamp, marsh, or lake. The terrain feature is permanently frozen and treated as open ground from now on. All models in the terrain feature when the spell is cast take a strength 2 hit with no armor save. Alternatively, this spell can be cast on a single unengaged enemy unit within line of sight. The target moves as if in difficult terrain in its next movement phase. A much better version of our freeze a body of water spell that we saw in the 4th edition book, this one has some actual utility to it. I don't think you're going to catch many units loitering in marshes, ponds, or rivers for those strength 2 hits. I do, however, love the fact that you can just make a unit move as if in difficult terrain. That can really mess up a battle line. I think you can get some use out of this spell in pretty much every battle in 6th, and not too difficult to cast on an 8. Next up is Form of the Frost Fiend. This also casts on an 8. The caster metamorphosizes into a shrieking taloned creature of Kislev legend. Carried across the battlefield in a whirlwind of purest cold, the caster may fly while this spell is in play. In addition, the caster has strength 5 and 4 attacks. The effects of all equipment, including magic items, steeds, and weapons, are ignored for the duration of this spell, as they are transmogrified along with the caster. The form of the Frost Fiend continues to work until it is dispelled, or until the wizard chooses to end it, which he can do at any time, attempts to cast another spell, or is slain. This is an interesting one. I don't know that you're going to want to use this too much, since it only alters 2 of her stats. If it altered her toughness, I think we'd be in much better shape. Also, she can't use her crystal cloak at this point, so you're looking at a toughness 3 model with 3 wounds and no save. I think it's very situationally useful, if you have to bully another wizard perhaps, or if you were already in combat anyway and you're not worried about having to take the ward save. Now we have the Invocation of the Ice Storm. Chanting words of power, the wizard summons a harsh blizzard that engulfs enemy marksmen and war machines. The caster nominates a point on the battlefield. Roll an artillery die and double the result. This is the distance in inches, measured from the nominated point, that the ice storm affects. If a misfire is rolled, it affects the entire battlefield. All units caught in the ice storm must pass a leadership -2 test when they wish to shoot. If this is failed, they are unable to fire. The freezing effects of the ice storm last for 1 full turn and cannot be dispelled in the opponent's next magic phase. This is a neat one, has a lot of implications for certain armies. Leadership -2 tests to fire could really shut down Orc and Goblin artillery quite well, and even has a good chance of shutting down Elven shooting. I think it's a really neat one, it's a very thematic one. And I really don't mind it as a cast on a 9 spell. I like any kind of utility spell like this that can really shut down an enemy, as opposed to just doing direct damage. Now we're getting into the big stuff. This is Midwinter's Kiss, and it casts on a 10. The caster breathes a great torrent of purest cold into the ranks of the enemy. Those caught in the blast turn to brittle statues of ice within seconds. Place the flame template with the pointed end touching the caster. Any model fully under the template is automatically affected, and any model partially under the template is affected on the roll of a 4+. Each model affected suffers a strength 5 hit with no armor save. This spell cannot be cast against units in close combat. That's a little bit of a poison pill at the end there, because that's exactly where you want to cast this spell, is when you get into close combat with units. Keep in mind, though, that Serena is mounted, so she can get around a fair bit. This is one heck of a breath weapon attack. Strength 5 with no armor saves. You could devastate a unit on 20mm bases, even 25mm bases. It's going to be harder to use because you can't breathe it while you're in close combat. But if you can get it off, I think it's a good one. But that may be a little tricky. Last up is Glacial Barrier. This casts on a 12 and remains in play. The wizard spreads her hands wide, causing the air itself to freeze into a wall of ice. This spell may be cast on any point within line of sight. Place a 5-inch by 1-inch strip of paper on the battlefield, all of which must be completely within 24 inches of the caster, to represent the glacial barrier. This is treated as impassable terrain and blocks line of sight. The glacial barrier can be charged or targeted as if it were an unbreakable enemy model, and is automatically hit in close combat. It is automatically destroyed if it is hit by an attack with strength 5 or greater, or by any flaming attack. All other attacks have no effect. Any unit that destroys the barrier in combat may not overrun. The glacial barrier continues to exist until it is dispelled, destroyed as above, or until the wizard chooses to end it, which she can do at any time, attempts to cast another spell, or is slain. This is a great example of what I was just mentioning about utility spells that can really shut down a unit or units. I like this one. It's not a hard barrier to knock down, just needing strength 5 or a single flaming attack. But what it does is it forces your opponent to waste resources or perhaps a turn, or if it's cast in a certain part of the battlefield where he doesn't have those kind of resources, his units have to move around it. Anything that messes up the opponent's battle plan is a big hit in my books as far as good spells go, and especially in 6th edition where you just don't see those insane damage spells that you would in later editions. Katarin's spell lore in both of these editions is really good. It's a nice mix of things, and it's tremendously thematic. I really wished that in this supplement, and I understand why they didn't do it in Hero Hammer, as Kislev really wasn't much of anything. It was 3 units, including Katarin herself. But in 6th edition, when we got this supplement, I really wish Games Workshop had added a generic Ice Mage that had access to this as well. It's incredible that Katarin gets her own spell lore, and it's very unique and makes her incredibly special and a really fun unit to take if you want to add some spice to your games, if you want to shake things up, because she's going to give you options to things that you probably haven't tried before and your opponent probably hasn't seen before. Though if there was even a level 1 Ice Mage that you could take, a sorceress, I think that would be really cool. Just get this lore out there a little bit more and see it played. I've honestly never run into anyone who has played Kislev or run Kislev as Empire allies, and I think that's just because those units weren't super common back in the day. They weren't really that easy to get even while in production, and certainly not now. But the lore of ice really does set them apart from all of the armies in this game. For a character that often gets overlooked, Katarin brings to the game more than so many other special characters do, and I'm going to be really interested in seeing what the future holds for her, but more so for the lore of ice and ice magic in Warhammer the Old World, as I would bet good money that we are going to get some ice sorceresses and ice witches when that game comes out. Before we end things off here, we're going to talk a little bit more about Boris Ursus, the Red Tsar. We discussed his backstory earlier. He's got a very cool backstory. I like characters like Boris who you get to see their whole story. They are historical characters within the timeline of Warhammer. I don't think Games Workshop does that enough. Things like Captain Tycho for the Blood Angels, where these are heroes from another age. And yes, they're not present in the current era, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be able to play them, set your games earlier, and I really like that Games Workshop went back in time when they added this character in. Also, Boris is just an absolute beast here, and I really wanted to share his stats with you guys. This is the only time we see him, and it's a bit of a shame because he has a great model mounted on a bear, and it makes me excited for the upcoming bear cavalry that we may get in the old world. So here is Boris Boka. He is movement 4, weapon skill 5, ballistic skill 4, strength 5, toughness 4, 3 wounds, initiative 3, and 4 attacks, with a leadership of 10. Erskine, his bear, is movement 6, weapon skill 4, strength 6, toughness 5, 3 wounds, initiative 4, 4 attacks, with leadership 7. If you would like to take Boris in your army, he will cost you 285 points, and to mount him on Erskine costs an additional 90 points. Boris carries the Shard Blade and is protected by the armor of Ursin and a shield. He is mounted on Erskine. And if you are fielding Boris in your army, you cannot field Katarin. And that just makes sense as they are father and daughter, and he was fighting in a different era. She would have been far too young. What I like about Boris so much is that his stat line is just off the wall for a human character in this game, and it makes sense that he is blessed by the bear god, so he is supernaturally strong. It just seems like a throwback stat line to the Hero Hammer era whenever I look at him, and I really like that. He has a few special rules here. He has Kin of the Bear God. If Boris Boka is taken as the leader of your allied contingent, then any units of Cossars present in the army may be designated as Kin of the Bear God at a cost of 30 points per unit. Models with the Mark of the Bear God gain +1 attack on the turn that they charge. Not a bad little buff there. Cossars are your base infantry. Would have been really nice if we could have put that on perhaps the Griffin Legion or the Winged Lancers. But the Cossars themselves are not bad at all, and they do carry great weapons, as well as bows and hand weapons. They're pretty much good to go however you want to fight, and I think you get some utility out of that, especially if you've got a big unit of them or two. Next up, he has the Armor of Ursin. Forged on the spring equinox, one of the holiest days of the cult of Ursin, the powdered bones of a score of the mightiest bears were mixed with the steel of the armor before it was quenched in the finest mead. This suit of armor is imbued with the power and might of Ursin himself, and those who wear it feel his power coursing through them. The armor of Ursin counts as full plate, which is a 4+ armor save. In addition, for each hit caused by enemies in close combat, the Tsar may make an additional attack back after enemies' attacks have been resolved, and assuming he's still alive. He may make those bonus attacks even if he has already attacked that phase. An incredible piece of kit there. You don't want to go charging Boris with a chaff unit, because any hits you'll get on him will just help him kill you quicker. You really want to make those attacks count if you're going to hit this guy, because he's going to hit you back. And speaking of that, he has the Shard Blade. Boris carries a mighty polearm with a blade crafted from ice hewn from glaciers of Norska, and magically bound by the ice wizards of Kislev to remain forever frozen. When Boris strikes a foe, shards of ice water enter the veins and freeze their blood. When using the Shard Blade, Boris adds +2 to his strength. So you're looking at a big ol' strength 7 Boris. In addition, any models who suffer a wound, after saving throws, etc., must take an immediate toughness test. If the test has failed, they suffer an additional wound, with no armor or ward save possible. Remember, a roll of 6 is always a failure, no matter the toughness of the opponent. The +2 strength is why you want this weapon, and the additional toughness test is a lovely bonus. Even against really tough monsters, there's still a 16% chance you're piling on an extra wound there. With his initiative of 3, he is going to strike after a lot of the faster troops in the game. However, he hits so hard, I don't think that's going to be too much of a problem. Plus his extra attacks for his armor, this guy can clear a room pretty easily. And that's not even talking about what his bear is going to do, as his bear strikes before him with 4 strength 6 attacks. And Erskine even has some special rules himself. He has winter coat. Erskine is swathed in thick layers of winter fat and muscle that protect him from the worst excesses of Kislev's harsh winter and blows of his enemies. As a result, he counts as having a 5+ armor save. I mean, it's something. It's certainly better than nothing. He has Thunder of Ursan. Erskine the bear causes fear. Again, makes sense, he's a big scary bear. Finally, he has Fury of Ursan. The ferocity of Erskine is such that should a unit fighting him break, he must always pursue it, regardless of the wishes of his rider. So that could be a real downside. Even still, Erskine is pretty good as far as a mount goes. Toughness 5 with a 5+ armor save, 3 wounds. Should at least keep him safe from basic missile fire until he gets across the table. He is pretty slow, though, at movement 6. I don't know how many charges you're getting off. And putting him in a cavalry unit, which you kind of want to do, because he's tough, but this is 6th edition, he isn't going to survive on his own, really slows down the cavalry unit, so there's some negatives as well as positives around Boris. Either way, I think he's a tremendously cool unit, an incredible sculpt. I wish he had stuck around. I wish Kislev had gotten more attention and love from Games Workshop. It's a little bit sad that they didn't. If you get a chance to download or find a copy of the Kislev supplement from 6th edition, it is well worth your time. There's a lot of fun stuff there that you will probably enjoy just reading through. Of course, there's a lore section, but there is also a section on modeling. There is a scenario called Purge the Steps, which looks very cool, and some tips on painting horses, creating winter-themed tables. There's all sorts of fun stuff here. It honestly makes up a little bit for Kislev being almost totally ignored in the Storm of Chaos, which was a really weird decision by Games Workshop. When I was researching for this episode, one of the first things I did was download Storm of Chaos, because I figured, oh, it's been a while since I've looked in that book. I'm sure it has a bunch of stuff on Kislev. I was mistaken. It had almost nothing on Kislev at all, which doesn't make a lick of sense. Other than the Chaos attack on Erengrad, there's really not too much there for them. So this is a much better way to explore Kislev than the Storm of Chaos book. And I'd be interested in knowing if any of you guys run Kislev as a allied force. What do you think of them? What are you hoping to see when Kislev comes to Warhammer the Old World, or even Warhammer Total War? Speaking of which, our next episode is going to be on Warhammer Total War. Scott and I are going to have a talk on the importance of Total War to the Warhammer community, some of our favorite and least favorite things about Total War, some of our stories, and probably most importantly, speculate on what we're going to see in Total War Warhammer 3, and what the future of that game could hold. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and learning more about Kislev and their Ice Queen. I had a lot of fun putting this one together, and it seemed so appropriate given the incredible trailer that Creative Assembly released for the upcoming Total War game. As soon as I saw it, I knew that I had to explore the lore of Catarin and her people. That's going to be all for this episode. I will talk to you next week. Until then, happy wargaming. Thanks for listening to this episode of the War Games Orchard. If you enjoy the show, why not support us on Patreon? Our Patreon is non-tiered, and for as little as a dollar, you can enjoy monthly bonus episodes, stories, and even more content coming soon. In this month's bonus episode, Scott and myself sit down and make 100% randomized Warhammer Fantasy roleplay characters from 1st edition. We let the dice decide literally everything about these characters, and the resulting characters will surprise you. They sure surprised us. If Patreon's not your thing, please consider giving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice and sharing this show with friends. You can get in contact with us by joining the Warhammer Orchard community on Facebook or by email at wargamesorchard@gmail.com. I saw Crucy put his hand on an ice witch once. To my knowledge, he's still out in that block of ice by the east gate.